Welcome to Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. I'm Carolyn Freeman, and today I am chatting with Dr. Seemal Asif about robotic deepfakes and the human-machine collaboration. Seemal is the head of the Intelligent Flexible Robotics Assembly Group at Cranfield University and senior lecturer in AI and robotics. She's also the course director for Intelligent Robotics. Welcome, Seemal. I'm so delighted to have you on board.
Thank you.
Seemal, before we get chatting about the work you do, can you tell me a little more about your journey into the field of robotics and what led you to focus on the human-machine collaboration?
So I started my professional journey as a software engineer during my studies. And through that, I was quite interested in the software development and software engineering side of the activities, progressed into senior software engineering post. But during that time, I got the scholarship and I came here for the MSc in software engineering in the University of York and finished that with the distinction as well. And then I got the opportunity when I was completing my master's, I got the opportunity to work at Cranfield University and various other places. I chose Cranfield University because the features they were offering in terms of the research. So it was a research fellowship post, giving me the outlook to work with the robots and with the larger robots, which I was quite excited to see. And I was like, oh, they are the big beasts and I want to tackle them. So that was something that excites me a lot. So I saw the robots in my first visit to the university. So right after my interview, my line manager took me to see the lab, and I was quite excited. So I chose Cranfield University because of that. And I was very excited to work with the robots. And that's where the robotic journey started. And I got interested in the industrial robots quite a lot. And till now, majority of my work is on the industrial robots, on the manufacturing applications, various applications in various industries, heavily with the Airbus. But some of the applications are sprouting up as well. And I got interested in the robotics.
How much of your initial software development work when you're working in industry do you now use in your kind of academic side of things?
A lot. Because programming is involved every field at the moment. As a boom of AI, as you are aware, is getting hold of every device and everything that we have at the moment. So it involves, it helps me quite a lot to understand and to kickstart as well. Or maybe I think I got the head start into that term. It helps me to understand and make the robot a bit more intelligent. I needed to learn quite a lot in terms of robotics. I am not shy of saying that. So I learned the mechanics of it, kinematics, dynamics, and all that kind of stuff. And then I'm teaching that as well to MSc Robotics and to various short courses. So one you named Italian Robotics. So I'm doing that as well on the basic level. And of course, I'm working on various other EPSRC projects. So that journey did help me to bond with the robots really well, and I was able to control them in a way I wanted rather than depending on various PLCs as well. So yeah.
So your work includes research at the Smart Cobotics Center. Could you talk a bit more about the center and its vision and what makes it different from other robotics research centers?
So Made Smarter project, we got that project 3 years ago, and the project finished in 31st of March. On that project we have six of the universities. I was working as co-investigator on that project, and what my research was about, to bring the human robot collaboration to the level that it includes the intelligence into it as well. And we tried to understand the human emotions, tiredness, fatigue, and tried to understand how we can make the robot adaptable to the human. rather than making the human adaptable to the robot tasks, how we can understand human emotions and what they are feeling, and based on that we can adjust the robot. So as we go along and go through our different phases of our life, we are not same every day. Sometimes we are very tired, especially if you have little kids and little babies, and sometimes we are very energetic and we really, really, really want to work. And as we age, our emotions also change. So there's another part of research that I'm not talking about. How we can understand what is happening in the human physiology, and then how we can translate it to the robot, and robot can adjust to it. So I didn't do that work alone. I have my researcher on that. Plus, I have human factors team involved. So industrial psychologists were involved with us, and we did that work hand to hand together. So we do have human factors team in our center who are working quite closer with us. We try to understand that. And the other part that I hinted on, that as we go through various phases of our life, as we age, our emotions are not the same. How I look like 30 years ago, 20 years ago, it's not exactly the same now. So and how we smile also varies. So it's difficult to solely rely on technology to understand what your emotions are. And that's where we introduce various other measures. So we introduced that, how can we understand it through the heart rate, and can we understand it through skin conductance? Can we understand it various other physiological measurements? Currently work is going on that as well. We collected the data through our feasibility studies, and now we are working on that and then understanding it. Although project finished, but research is not going to finish. So we'll find one or other venue to continue that.
So how do the robots actually get to understand the human emotions and the facial features, and whether or not someone's smiling or tired? Are they linked up to a machine or a human, or is there a connection between them, or is it kind of a visual thing? How do they actually read it?
So that's a nice question. And how we did that is we enabled the robots by using various sensors. So those sensors can be the cameras. And in that case, we use the cameras. We use different tracking cameras as well. So those are different to the webcams, in which we understood the skeletal movements to understand the situation awareness around the human. And we also use the eye tracking glasses. So we use the various wristbands as well. We used various other physiological measurement devices to understand the human emotions and the facial expressions and those type of things. And of course, there is machine learning, heavy machine learning behind those sensors to make sure that we can extract what does it mean, and then can send it to the robot, because it won't be automated in that way, especially when you have so many sensors integrated.
And then you use the psychologists in that process of understanding the readings and understanding the translation of that,
yes,
programming it back into the machine.
Yes, yes, yes. Otherwise, as an engineer, we won't be able to understand what does tiredness mean, or what does fatigue mean. I mean, these are the things that alienated to the engineers. So we get the third eye from the psychologists, and it was great experience to working with them.
Is there any concern about the proximity of robots and human safety in terms of human safety and productivity? And are there any other challenges that you face in this kind of human-machine collaboration?
Yeah, proximity-wise, there is quite a lot that has been done in that space. So there are various types of human-robot collaboration as well. So you can share the workspace, or you don't share the workspace, or you work in different time settings, like robot is doing the job and then human is not involved, but robot is finished, then human is involved. So you can utilize any of those spaces. It's solely based on the application. And of course, safety is paramount to it. So safe, you need to make sure that it's safer to work with the robot. whether you are sharing the space or not sharing the space, whether you have open cell or not open cell. So in any of those circumstances, there is a proper risk assessment that we carried out, and we understood that what type of safety measures we need to deploy, and it has to be optimum enough to make sure that we can carry out the work comfortably.
And where do you see this going in terms of the implications for industry and its practical use within industry going forward?
Yeah, human-robot collaboration in industry, if you see, it's not that much adopted. It's not heavily adopted. It's something, a lot of times it's like not sharing the workspace is actually the other area that I was talking about in the human-robot collaboration. So a robot finishes the job and then the human operator is going in and then carry out the job, which is fine. That means that is something that industry requires. But in some application, it does happen that you do need to share the workspace. So there are various industrial standards and we adhere to them as well. But as the research is always advanced to the standards, we always give our indications that this is something that needs to be done and can be done a bit more. So Dr. Sarah Fletcher, she is our principal research fellow, and she heads the human factors group of industrial psychologists in our center. We work quite closely with her team and then try to understand it. But industry wise, it's like a pushing rather than doing a fully automation. At the moment, what UK industry is struggling is something that we want to retain the skills, and we want to make sure that we don't lose those skills. Skill work craft, the craftsmanship is something that is diminishing, and how we can do that rather than fully automating everything, we want to make sure that human is in the loop, and you can only bring the human in the loop if you take care of what basically entails with those type of things. So what human-robot collaboration means, how we can make it safer, how we can make sure that we can have really nice task design. So there's quite a lot of things that comes along with it. How you design your task, how you implement it, how you carry out that. It does need reviewing as well.
Yeah. And it kind of still means that the human can add value into any production process or in an industrial process, yeah, that's and still retain some kind of, yeah, value added in their work and feeling proud of their work and still, as you say, still retaining, yeah, their skill sets.
Exactly. Exactly.
And for the past few years, you've had a humanoid robot called Neo that has been part of the lab. And Neo can interact with humans through his kind of vision to recognize a face and can also follow very specific voice instructions. But firstly, can you define what a humanoid robot is?
So, I mean, there are various definitions of the humanoid robot. So the humanoid robot that looks like human can interact with human, mainly the social settings, and should not be posing risk to the human itself as well. So it doesn't need, so now robot, if you have seen that, it's quite lightweight. I mean, even if it hunts you, it won't be able to harm you, but there's a big but. When we say human-robot collaboration, and especially with the humanoid robot, it depends what you give it into their hand. Even if it is an industrial robot, if you have human-robot collaboration, it solely, if you are using the human, the collaborative robot, for example, or a collaborative machine, and you attach a knife towards the end of the collaborative machine, it's not a collaborative system anymore. Similarly, with the humanoid robot, we also need to understand what and where we are using it. So it has to be properly risk assessed. And I mean, I'm using risk assessment quite a lot during this conversation, but this is quite crucial to make sure that we can understand, and it has to be, the task needs to be designed appropriately. And with the humanoid robot, because they are powered by AI, if you are using in the nursery settings where the children are, needs to be appropriately trained and make sure that all the contents that are not appropriate needs to be removed. Similarly, if it has been used for sprouting the conversation in the old homes, it has to be properly risk assessed as well. So those type of things needs to be considered when deploying these type of robots. But it's great tool to bring and sprout the conversations and to help aid the intelligence as well for the little kids. And yeah, it's a great tool. It depends where we use it.
Yeah, I think that's the key. It depends on where you use it and how it's been trained, and kind of almost setting parameters and boundaries on what it's able to do rather than just letting it go wild and have the ability to hurt a human.
Yeah.
As part of the video on the Smart Chaotic Center, your team are using ChatGPT to increase Snail's capacity and ability to learn and kind of understanding human input. Do you think there are dangers in using AI to train humanoid robots?
Yes. Yes, we do understand there are a lot of dangers to use. It depends how you train it, and it depends what you train and in which environment you are going to use. And that's where I said there it has to be embedded into the right from its risk assessment that we are using the AI to train the robots. But these are the circumstances, and this is the data that we are going to use to train the system. And similarly, in our work with the Smart Cobotics Center, what we did is we created our own data set. And at the moment, we are under the process of creation of that data set because we have finished off the trials and we collected the data set. And now we are sort of normalizing it, understanding it, and making it an appropriate data set so it can be released to the public space. But what we can do there is to make sure the appropriate data sets can be gone into the training, because and it has to be viable and fit to the environment. So if we collected a data set that is from a YouTube video or from a movie and to understand the facial expression, that may not necessarily be applied in the same way when you use that in the industrial setting. So if your model is being trained in a different environment, it will be difficult for it to understand that into a industrial environment. So it has to be, those parameters need to be, so environmental settings are important, as well as what you are trying to do with it is also important as well.
So it's going back to what we said earlier about setting really strong guardrails, and this is what you learn, and this is the stuff that we're training you on, and these are the prompts, and these are parameters to make sure that it's kept safe and not just kind of going into deep fake kind of stuff. From your perspective, what role do humanoid robots play in shaping our perceptions of machine, and especially in kind of collaborative work settings?
You mean posing the risk?
Yeah, they often shape our perceptions. So we kind of see videos and we see things on YouTube or on news reports on what humanoid robots can do. And there's also kind of a lot of movies on humanoid robots. So how can kind of what you're doing potentially shape future perceptions?
So first of all, we need to understand. So your previous question was related to like what are the dangers of using like ChatGPT or we say the LLMs, large language learning models to train the robots. So if we are, the first danger is like hallucination. So it might, for example, like the if we are using LLM to make up some facts in robotics, like fake instructions can physically damage the robot or even its environment as well. So if we don't understand it and don't control those factors, it could be quite dangerous. So you can't give the robot and also the LLM into the hands who don't understand what the robotics control means, because it can be quite dangerous to the environment. And similarly, it applied to any type of robot. It applied to the humanoid, and even in more because delicate settings, because there you are interacting with a human next to you, because the AI, it doesn't have the physical grounding, so like force friction. It can have a failure to it. It can have the context loss, like long-term memory and the state awareness. It's quite limited. It's not a human. who can understand the context in that way. So it can, it needs a persistent knowledge of the environment itself as well. So it depends who is using it and how it's being used in terms of the humanoid environments as well. So what I would say is that we need to have the risk assessment matrix in that way as well, and understanding the realistic scenarios, like what will happen if you do the torso movement of the robot in that way. If you misunderstand any social cue, like robot nod, but move differently, as we are, because I'm not an industrial psychologist, but we live in different cultures, and every culture has different gestures of saying anything. So it means maybe good in English culture, but it may mean negative in the other culture in the world. So it and vice versa. So it depends where it's been used and how it's been used and how it's been trained. It's quite important.
That's a really good point. I never thought about that in terms of different cultures have different expressions and different ways of different body language and different ways of making meaning of words and language. Because I'm just kind of off the top of my head thinking about the Indian culture where that kind of a yes is, I can't do the way of doing it, but a shaking of the head is a yes, whereas in the English culture, shaking of the head is a no. And it's just simple things like that that it's easy to misinterpret if you've got someone from a slightly different culture.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
And I'm guessing also there's nuances in kind of the way we say words. So even within the UK, there's so many different dialects of English that being able to understand Scottish versus Irish versus Yorkshirean or Geordie is very different from south of England. So it's kind of, there's a lot of different nuances that are never considered in terms of how you train a robot from a voice perspective and a visual perspective.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Going on to the recent paper you spoke about during our initial chat called Unmasking Deepfakes, the research raises some really important ethical and psychological concerns. What first drew you to explore deepfakes in relation to kind of human-machine collaboration?
So, like deepfakes in terms of the human-machine in collaboration, because if you are as you know, that the, like, for example, the any LLMs, you name the model, they are all trained on the data that is available, depending on what they have with the set. It's been trained on, it's available online, and the or being generated or augmented artificially to be trained. When we use that in the human robot collaboration setting, we need to be very mindful how it's been used and how it's been basically, is it addressing the concerns that we are quite worried about, because the fake, if you create anything fake in these environments, it is quite damaging to the society. And we have seen different cases throughout that. What does that mean? And we shouldn't be seeing those cases. It needs to be addressed before these things are. And that's why we need to regulate the AI. And the reason of those of that type of research, and I'm doing that with my PhD student, Sami Alanazi, is to make sure that we can understand the importance of deepfake, first of all. That is quite that is something that needs to be done, and that's how the LLMs, I mean, they use similar engines at that as well, but also how socially it can be harmful. So if we are working with these, I mean, we are as human are also at risk of that as well. So there are a lot of ethical challenges that are in that domain. So that, like, if your integration, the integration of deepfake AI in robotics, is particularly the misinformation, identity fraud, privacy violation, and I mean, you name it, a lot of things can come out from those things as well. And in terms of human-robot collaboration, my understanding, my thinking is that that's where we are pushing over there as well, is we need a framework of trustworthiness of AI. Can we push toward it? Can we work toward it? We created this technology, but we need to be responsible for that. So it has to be responsible AI, but also it needs to be a trustworthy AI, and it needs to have the principles of transparency, accountability, and fairness. I mean, without those principles, it will become impossible. And the deepfake who is enhancing the robot could be misused for deception or manipulation as well. Like, for example, if a service robot represent a human like avatar, so it must clearly disclose its AI nature to prevent the confusion. So similarly, robots making recommendation, whether it's medical, financial, or legal, should provide the explanation of their decisions, like the evidences behind the scene. In our point of view, the explainability mechanism, such as AI-generated justification for the robotic behavior, it basically needs to, it will give more trust to the user and will mitigate some risks associated with the AI opacity, you can see. The ethical AI frameworks, such as IEEE 7001 or IEEE 7003, the algorithm bias consideration, they guide the developers in identifying mitigation biases. But are we implementing? Because standards are there. They need to go, first of all, in the deeper depth, what we are facing at the moment, especially after the heavier use of the deepfakes and also the LLMs and also the implementation of that and understanding of that at the government level is quite crucial as well.
I'm assuming that is very difficult to train a machine or a humanoid robot in terms of understanding what is real and deepfake, because deepfake is so nuanced and also it changes so quickly that it's really difficult to say, well, Neo, humanoid robot, this is a deepfake and you can recognize it this way, because it's so difficult. So you're really relying on those standards to be in place so that you can stop that happening, really.
But how many times you have seen those standards being linked to any model that you use? Any app that you download, have you seen that it adheres to this standard? Or it is using this data to give you that understanding? We need to make sure as a society and at every level, we need to make sure that there are, as with any industry, this is a huge industry. So as any industry, these type of standards are adhered to. Otherwise, we are blocking it or we are not letting it to go into the public domain. So a lot of responsibility really goes on the shoulder of the technology creators and also to the technology regulators.
Because this could really impact the future of humanoid robots and human robot collaboration, can't it? If there are security concerns around deepfake and whether or not there are these structures in place and whether or not there's the ethics and the guardrails already in place from a legal point of view. Where do you think the future is with kind of humanoid robots and human robotic collaborations?
Okay, humanoid, because we can do the human robot collaboration with the industrial robot as well. And humanoid robot are inherent with the human robot collaboration. So I will just look at it as a human robot collaboration. The future is, research wise, we pushed a lot towards the human robot collaboration. We tried to see it through the safety point of view. We tried to understand it, what safety implementation can be done, how we can do the human robot collaboration in various settings. So research is there. How we can take that basic research to the next level is another another understanding, and we have done that with Airbus at different levels through the ATI funded projects. For the wider industry, I think we need a, like we have done it through the Made Smarter Center, through the Smart Robotics Project, we need a lot of those type of projects in which we can closely interact with the industry, understand their needs, and so that various feasibility studies can sprout through that, and that will help us to understand what industry needs and what's the requirement, and will help the industry to take that technology a bit further as well, and basically upgrade it. And that is what required at the moment to the industry in the country.
And the paper also talks about digital literacy. How important do you think digital literacy is, and how can someone go about gaining that digital literacy in this area?
In the area of deepfakes or in the area of...
With humanoid robots and deepfakes is part of that as well.
Digital literacy is quite important nowadays. You know, we can see our older generations on the mobile as well all the time. I have seen my mom, grandparents on the mobile, going and flicking through the social media and clicking on different links, and then emails coming up. We have seen and heard different stories as well in which the money has been dropped from their accounts without them being given the consent, but actually they clicked on some link, provided some information unknowingly. So digital literacy is hugely important in this paradigm. As we are going along through the era of era of artificial intelligence at the moment, it's far more important to understand and sort of diagnose those things as well. This is fake. This is not fake. I can trust it. I cannot trust it. It's technologically important. It's the responsibility of the creators, but also of the users as well. Because if users are utilizing something which is negative, creators are being, fed by those things, and they will create it no matter what. They will not understand the ethical grounding. And of course, for the regulators, so these things shouldn't sprout. And regulators do quite a lot of things, but I think as a society, we need to do something about it as well, to point it out, to give the understanding, because we may not have seen quite a lot of things that public can see. So reporting the issues, we need the framework and the mechanism really to give us the understanding. So that was around the deepfakes and the humanoid robots. And the humanoid robots, as I suggested earlier in the beginning, that it depends where they are being used and how they have been trained. It's quite important. So it needs to be responsibly trained for various environments, and how they are interacting and what they are seeing is also quite important, and has to be specific for that environment, specific for that need as well. So you can't generalize it.
So it's also the people that are working with the robots in that real environment need to be trained in terms of their digital literacy of what they need to feed it and how they need to interact with it and what the safe working practices. So it's not just about deep fakes, it's about how you actually work and cooperate together.
It's not only about the users, it's about the creators as well. So if we train our young generation now, what is their responsibility when they are creating the technology? So it's AI at the moment. Who knows, it will be a different thing 20 years after. So if we train an ethical ethically responsible generation, it will be impacted. So how this technology is being used, where it can be used, and who is designing it, what are the frameworks, they need to be designed and they need to be embedded into it, like we are teaching manners to our kids, and it will make a good person in the long run. And similarly, we need to teach our kids from very young age what does this mean? What does the creation mean? And of course, we need to bring, and diversity is hugely important. I cannot stress the importance of diversity in the technology creation as well. You will see less number of females and other marginalized diversity groups in the technology creations. We need to bring more, and that will impact hugely into the whole outlook of this space as well.
Yeah, absolutely agree. Yeah, because it is, it's going back to what we said before about you need that diversity of different everything, yeah, really, to properly train.
Everything, yes.
I'd love to chat about the work you're doing at Cranfield University now. And you're currently a senior lecturer and associate professor at Cranfield University. What is the main focus of the work that you do there?
So I'm a senior lecturer in AI and robotics in some places that calls associate professor as well. So, and that's where like it's a slash. So my work is around various projects. So I do teach MSc Robotics and MSc CSDE as well. So I teach the robotics control and also the machine learning as well. So the modules around it. And the other work that I do is with my PhD students who do quite a lot of research. So one of them is doing the deepfake AI. A couple of them are doing work around the robotics, main robotics itself. So around the grippers, camera calibrations, so calibration of different various sensors, situation awareness, and those type of things. And most of my work goes towards various projects. So like EPSRC funded projects, one of them was smart robotics, and the other ones are R3M. I do work, and that basically gave us the understanding at the lower TRL basic level research, so TRL 1, 2, 3. And then I do work with the ATI funded projects with the companies like Airbus, and also with the at the moment we have the X-ray open X-ray system with the Adaptics with an IHM. And what we do with those systems is to make sure that we can do the work in an open space rather than providing the barriers, physical barriers, because it will hinder quite a lot of human-robot collaboration, first of all. And also, it will when you are opening up the space, it does bring make it easier for the factory flow line to work along as well. So yeah, we do quite a lot of these things. I'm working on those type of projects, and a couple of them are coming up. And so my work is to work on is in stages. So I do work on the lower TRLs, in which we do basic blue sky research, and then we take it further to the higher TRLs, and then try to push it to the industry. And a couple of our examples are already in the industry itself as well, like I mentioned, the Airbus.
And if anyone is interested in finding out more about your courses and working with you, what would that involve, and how can they find out more?
They can go on our website, search our center. I do lead IFRA, Intelligent Flexible Robotics Assembly, and part of that I have 19 members. So we have 7 PhD students, myself, and we have 3 RAs and 1 RF. And we are specialized in various areas like metrology and human-robot collaboration, and understanding of the robotics control, development of basic robots to taking it to the higher level. So we do that. And they can search our group. They can search our Center for Robotics and Assembly. We are part of, as a group, we are part of Center for Robotics and Assembly Center in our Cranfield University. They can come over. The salient feature is we have quite a lot of industry involvement. We don't have undergrads, we have only masters and PhD students, but our majority of our work, depending on the industry and funding from the government, on through which we do a lot of research and bringing it and excelling in research, and then of course helping the industry to adopt it as well. So So we do run short courses, intelligent robotics, you have mentioned earlier. So feel free to come along and contact us. You can find my contact details on our websites as well. And you can also, contact our short course center as well.
And those are 2- and 5-day courses. And are those kind of industry focused, that if someone is in business or an industry, that they yes. come along to those courses?
Exactly, exactly. Because they are in a block. So 2 days courses, they'll come over, stay over, and they will go through. It's like a quite crash course, and we are running it in May. And we have, continuous stream of delegates on that. We can also offer a bespoke courses as well. So once they have done the flavor of, for example, intelligent robotics, they can come a lot of times they come up and they say, can you do the bespoke course for like 5 days in our location, in our space, and we do design that, and then we tailor that to their needs, and then we do that as well. The good feature about our short courses is we don't just teach them PowerPoints. We work with them on the real robots. So we bring the robots into the lab, we bring them into our labs, and so they can work alongside the robot, they can learn the real skills rather than just feeding through the PowerPoint. Even if it is a 2 day short course, doesn't matter. We do find a ways to do that. And why we can do that is because we have long history of working with the industry and also through various different projects as well.
What advice would you give to young researchers or maybe students interested in exploring the intersection of robotics, psychology, and AI?
That's quite, that is something that is, will be coming up as our next demanding profession. So the intersection of robotics, AI, and psychology. You can't, I'm from the generation in which you've been taught the engineering, and engineering means like you cannot understand the human emotions. Emotions are something that is alienated to it, and they are aliens. But I think that is very, very important to understand, and it gives you third eye. We did have some courses. It's not like I haven't done any of those type of courses. We did have some courses in our undergrad as well, but it's like the focus is more on the engineering. We do need a good balance there as well. So we need the generation of the engineers who really understand these type of that will be quite helpful in the in understanding how to do the human robot collaboration in the future. But also at the moment, when we are doing the interdisciplinary research, you can gel very well together with the teams, and then can understand the other person and other field engineer or other field expert. What does it entails in terms of how they are coming along? And it does can provide, if you have the mixture of both, you can come up with a common terminology, which is very, very important. And it does give boost to the research. So what I would advise to them is to the future engineers, is to be responsible. That is coming up through my research, is to be responsible whatever they are creating, and make sure that it is ethically viable, because we can create anything that we want. It's about the need, and secondly, about when, even if it is a need, we need to make sure that it is ethically, socially viable. You can be the user as well. So just to make sure that it is being addressed in that way.
It sounds as though the way that we're educating software engineers going forward is no longer just about you have to be a mathematician and you have to understand coding, and you think logically and systematically. But there's got to be more than that. There's got to be the social soft side as well that you have to understand. So the ethics and the legal side, as well as then the human side and how we act. And so it's quite a cross dynamic of what you really need to understand if you're going to go into this field.
Exactly, exactly. It's like any other engineering. Engineers are held responsible. For example, if mechanical engineer do anything that is not in the standards, they will be held responsible. Software engineering is quite complex in that way. And I do understand that it's quite complex to regulate it as well. But we do need the software engineers to come forward, and we do need a framework and committees to do the grasp understanding rather than just bureaucratic understanding of what is happening. It's like embedding them into the system and then try to understand what can be done, because there are a lot of things that can be done. And that's where my research is pushing. This is the thing. These are the frameworks. These are the laws in various areas in the world. But what can be done and what is already out there, it's not enough. There's a huge gap. And we need to make sure that we can fill that gap. We can't fill that fully, but we need to make sure that we take first step.
Seema, we're coming to the end of our chat today. And the first question I want to ask you in the last two questions is, what is the most important thing I haven't asked you yet?
I think you ask a lot of questions around the human-robot collaboration and also the responsibility. And I mean, that's a topic I really, really like to talk about, is to understand. The one important thing, and I think I touched it slightly, is the diversity in the area is as important as anywhere in any industry, in any organization. When I joined my center, I was the only female in the robotics area working in the and then I had a team, and slowly from the last 2-3 years we had another female team member, female engineer. But it's as we progress in our career, it's something that is declining. So I think that something needs to be done at the foundation level to attract young ladies towards STEM. And because I can see that is something that is in decline. They don't love maths, and that is quite crucial in engineering. So I think something that needs to be done from the cradle to the next, even before the nursery level, to give that understanding, because we are all users of technology. And if we don't have the representation in the creation of the technology, this is something that we are missing a huge bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is a drive towards STEM, but I think it kind of, part of it, I wonder if it's kind of helping young people understand what the output is of going into STEM. Mm-hmm. So it's not just learning maths and engineering just for the sake of it. It's about what can you do with it going forward, and what kind of value can you add being part of this STEM career progression.
Yeah, exactly.
And the last question I have is, looking ahead, what excites you about the future of humanoid robotics, AI, and human-machine collaboration? And what impact do you think this may have on us as kind of individuals and society?
Okay, so individually, so I'll talk about the society as industry, because that's what our work, quite a lot of times our work is about, how we can add the value to the industry through that work. It will be even still now, up till date, there are quite a lot of processes that can be upgraded through the technology. There's quite a lot of processes that are using old technology, can be replaced by the newer technology. It requires time, investment, and also quite a lot of research in that area. First of all, we need funding to do that. And second of all, we need the push from the industry and the interest from the industry to do that. We are lagging behind compared to our European counterparts, we are very much behind in terms of AI and robotics, both of them. In terms of industry, we are very, very good in the research of robotics, but we are not very good by attempts to the industrial implementation. And that's something that is the gap that we need to address. And there are quite a lot of programs that are out there through which we can address it. But still, there is quite a lot of push that needs to be done, because opportunities are very less. And I mean, you can have a lot of applicants for that. So that is one thing that needs to be pushed through the government to make sure that we can do something in that. And I think what would be exciting to see, I mean, after having that technology been adopted, is something that we can increase the, it will be economically beneficial, first of all, because the increase of, it's not about only about the increase of automation, it's about retaining your skilled labors as well, because we are talking about the human-robot collaboration. And it's also not only economically beneficial, it will be quite, it's like as upgrading the skills. So it will be very good added value for the human operator itself as well. If they are psychologically feeling better, they will be working better. And then, of course, when we are creating so many goods within the country, it will be better for the economy, it will be cheaper. And for financially, it will be longer run, it will be very, very viable. So the investment that we do now to bridge that gap, the gap between academia and the industry will be beneficial in the long run.
Simil, thank you so much for joining me on Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. It was fabulous to catch up with you, and I really look forward to chatting to you again in the future.
Thank you so much, Caroline, for providing me the opportunity.